From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Despite approval from a majority of Florida voters, a constitutional amendment guaranteeing access to abortion fails in the 2024 election.
With Ron DeSantis in the governor's mansion for the next 2 years, the reality is these laws will not change.
Also last year, a former Florida attorney general becomes the incoming president's top, but not first, pick for U.S. attorney general.
Her background is going to be insignificant compared to the other nominees. This is smooth sailing.
We'll also reconsider a controversial move during the past year to allow commercial development in Florida state parks and examine new bans on social media access by young kids. I'm Tom Flanagan. We'll revisit the top stories of 2024 from our team of Capitol reporters coming up in this edition of Capitol Report. On Election Day, more than 57% of Floridians voted in favor of a state constitutional amendment that would have protected access to abortion. But the proposal still failed, and a law that bans most abortions after 6 weeks remains in place. Regan McCarthy has this story about why amendments in Florida need a higher threshold, 60% approval, to pass.
Devastated. That's how outgoing state Democratic Senator Lauren Book says she feels when she thinks about the amendment results.
It's a difficult day when you have to look at your daughter in the face and know that you failed her.
Book has been an outspoken abortion rights supporter. She worries under the current ban, more women will see their abortions delayed or denied. And she's worried that will end up costing some of them their lives. She says it's frustrating to see that more than 57% of voters agreed women should have access to abortion up to the point of viability.
And because of this arbitrary 60% threshold, that is not going to be the case in Florida. And that is a very painful thing.
Some advocates have said the support from most voters sends a clear message to lawmakers. They're hopeful that could mean the state will repeal the current ban in the upcoming legislative session. Book says she's determined to keep fighting, but she calls that idea a false bill of goods.
Because with Ron DeSantis in the governor's mansion for the next 2 years, the reality is these laws will not change.
Book worries the vote has emboldened the state legislature. She's expecting a renewed push for a bill filed last session that some worried could pave the way for establishing fetal personhood. Abortion opponents are also looking ahead to the next legislative session. Andrew Sherville founded the group Florida Voice for the Unborn. He wants to see a change in the rules surrounding the petition gathering process. And he'd like to see the state pursue a total ban on abortion.
We think now we have the high ground with the people of Florida rejecting Amendment 4.
Sherville acknowledges their recent vote indicates most Floridians support abortion access, but he doesn't think those results are accurate. He says if people had a better understanding of what the proposal would do, he thinks more of them would have voted no.
But again, that doesn't really mean anything because a victory is a victory for our side. And they could have had 59.9% and we still would have won.
All of that leads to the question. Why does Florida require 60% approval for its proposed amendments to pass? As it turns out, that answer has something to do with pig farming.
The official name was Animal Cruelty Amendment Limiting Confinement of Pregnant Pigs.
Aubrey Jewett is a political science professor at the University of Central Florida. He says in the early 2000s, animal rights activists were concerned about pigs kept in small pens. State lawmakers were frustrated that voters wanted language around pig farming and high-speed rail, for example, added to the state constitution. Jewett says lawmakers felt like it was too easy for voters to go around them.
Most legislatures, if they are controlled by one party for a period of time, typically don't like direct democracy as much.
In 2006, Florida lawmakers put a proposal on the ballot that would require 60% approval for future amendments. Ironically, the measure passed with just under 58% of the vote. That was the last time 50% of the vote would pass an amendment. In recent years, lawmakers have filed bills to raise the bar to two-thirds. While historically that measure hasn't made it very far, some wonder if this could be the year. I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
One of President-elect Donald Trump's many cabinet picks from Florida is former State Attorney General Pam Bondi. Tristan Wood reports, although she was Trump's second choice for U.S. Attorney General, Bondi has been his longtime ally.
Bondi was nominated just hours after former Panhandle U.S. Representative Matt Gaetz withdrew from being considered for the role. His nomination brought bipartisan criticism, citing concerns about his lack of experience as an attorney and allegations that he sex trafficked a minor. Barry University political science professor Sean Foreman says Gaetz stepping down shocked no one.
Why Trump thought about nominating Gaetz in the first place is a bit of a mystery. Was he a foil to, you know, say, hey, look at this guy, and when he gets shot down, then it makes it easier for other nominees to get through? Or did they really think they could push Matt Gaetz through this process? Or is there another plan for putting Matt Gaetz in a different position down the road? So I think that needs to be revealed in time.
Bondi's selection made more sense to state political watchers. She was Florida's attorney general from 2011 to 2019. She was a prosecutor in Hillsborough County for almost 20 years before that. Bondi also has a long-standing professional relationship with Trump, getting campaign donations from his foundation all the way back in 2013, serving on a drug policy panel under his last administration, and being one of his attorneys during his first impeachment trial. Unlike Gaetz, she is also in the good graces of Republicans nationally. As Florida AG, she signed on to a national lawsuit opposing the Affordable Care Act. She also advocated for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation process, appearing in national ads supporting him.
The Senate needs to put gridlock aside and confirm Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
Her conservative bona fides aside, she previously signaled support for issues that now run counter to the direction of her party. In 2017, as Florida AG, she signaled support for LGBTQ employment protections when a bill codifying those protections was making its way through the Florida legislature. Here she is speaking with WFSU at the time.
Of course, it's something I would support. We've always had a great policy in my office regarding LGBTQ employees in my office and protecting their rights. I'd love to take a look at it. Of course I would, sure.
Foreman doesn't think she will have any difficulty getting confirmed by the Senate.
She was one of the attorney generals who brought the case of the states fighting against Obamacare. So liberals are going to be upset about that. But all of it that I'm saying is basically her background is going to be insignificant compared to the other nominees. This is smooth sailing. I think this is an easy check mark now for the Trump administration to say they've got a solid attorney general nominee in place.
Bondi is also a partner at the lobbying firm Ballard Partners. Justin Safey, also a partner at the firm, applauded her nomination. He says her selection, along with several other high-profile appointments to the Trump administration from Florida, will serve the state's residents well.
Florida has really punched below its weight in Washington for many years, and as a longtime Florida resident, I'm delighted to see the large number of Floridians that are now going to be in positions of power and influence in Washington, D.C.
Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried agrees that Florida Republicans have been at the center of forming Trump's administration, but views that as a negative.
They're wanting to make Florida, make America Florida. And we've been the lab rats of Project 2025 for the last 6 years. And so that's what's happening. You know, that Trump is taking a lot of Florida people up with him to Washington, D.C., and it's one unethical person after the other.
What direction she will take as U.S. Attorney General is unclear, but Trump seems convinced he has found his person, writing in his announcement post that she will be a, quote, America First fighter. I'm Tristan Wood.
Months after Governor Ron DeSantis' administration introduced controversial plans to bring resort-style lodges and sports courts to state parks, a Stewart lawmaker has filed a measure to make such proposed changes off-limits. State Senator Gail Harrell has filed a bill that would strike golf courses, tennis courts, pickleball courts, and ball fields from recreational uses at state parks. The Stewart Republicans' proposal, dubbed the State Park Preservation Act, also would limit camping cabins to a maximum of 6 occupants. Governor Ron DeSantis says he's pulling the plug on a State Department of Environmental Protection plan to build golf courses, hotels, and other amenities in Florida's much-loved state parks. As Margie Menzel reports, the bipartisan outrage that greeted the plan could become legislation to prevent another such episode and to move the parks forward.
Protests erupted across the state when the public learned of DEP's plans.
We're here to send a clear message on behalf of the 30 million visitors to our state parks, Floridians, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and everyone in between, respectfully, to our governor and FDEP and the developers. Keep your greedy, grubby hands out of our state parks.
That was Leon County Commissioner David O'Keefe hyping up the crowd at one protest in Tallahassee. 24 hours later...
Here's the thing. I'd rather not spend any money on this, right? I mean, if people don't want improvements, then don't do it.
Governor DeSantis disavowed DEP's proposals at a press conference the next day. He says the plans were leaked to a, quote, left-wing group. The story was broken by the Tampa Bay Times. Later, DEP posted its plan online while announcing a public comment period for people to weigh in. The protests occurred at the time DEP had initially designated as its public comment period, between 3 and 4 p.m. on Tuesday, August 27th. They would have been held at the same time at each of the 9 affected parks so that no one could speak at more than one. The move was blasted by state office holders, with Republican Congressman Brian Mast calling it, quote, absolutely ridiculous. The collective outrage was as bipartisan a response as Florida has seen in years. Audubon Florida Executive Director Julie Rathmel says she wasn't surprised.
The environment has always been a bipartisan issue in Florida because the environment is our economy. And so it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, nobody wants green water. And everybody wants a beautiful beach and abundant wildlife in our forests and recreational opportunities for our families and our children.
Rathmel also believes people on both sides of the aisle were troubled by the process.
I could imagine being a decision maker and being a little frustrated with the way that it rolled out and not having some awareness personally before having to really consider the proposals publicly.
Eric Draper was the director of Florida's state parks for 4 years. He says DEP skirted the legal process for approving changes to the parks and that the rallies wouldn't have happened otherwise. But now, he says, the outraged response could be the basis for more funding to address the backlog of needs in the parks.
This has been the only issue I can remember in Florida that has united Republican and Democrat and Independents. No matter what your political beliefs are, you think this is a bad idea. And no matter what your political beliefs are, you love Florida parks and you would agree that we should invest more in our state parks.
For instance, Draper says Floridians should make sure park staffers are adequately paid and housed. He says some of those staffers live in substandard housing at the parks where they work.
Florida state parks have a billion-dollar backlog of unfunded repairs.
Now Draper has taken his list to Republican State Senator Gail Harrell, whose district completely contains Jonathan Dickinson State Park, one of the parks where the state proposed altering the terrain to build golf courses. Harrell has strong ties to the park and says she's grateful to everyone who raised a voice in its defense.
But I was concerned that this might happen again and that this outcry might not be enough to forestall it totally, completely. So I said, how do we make sure that this could not happen again?
Although others will be watching carefully to protect the parks, Harrell wants something in law.
So that's what my mission is really to make sure we craft legislation very carefully to outline the function and purpose of a state park. And for me, it is to preserve this natural environment, to preserve our historical sites for our future, for the grandchildren. I've got 8 of them. I want them to come and enjoy it, just like my kids did.
While it isn't yet clear what precipitated the state's plans, the conservative outlet The Capitalist points to a law that went into effect July 1st. It allows proposals to skip the competitive bidding process. But Harrell says she doesn't think the new law was a factor, and she wrote in a text, quote, "We will look at it carefully as we craft legislation to make sure this doesn't happen again." Harrell agrees with Draper that the bill should include funding for the parks. She points to money from the state's gambling compact with the Seminole Tribe as a potential funding source. That law specifies that state revenue from gambling should be used for the environment. I'm Margie Menzel.
The latest uniform crime figures from the FBI show that Florida ranks second among the states, behind only California, when it comes to fraud schemes targeting senior citizens.
1,000 complaints of elder fraud filed just last year alone. Some of those victims saying they were cheated out of their entire life savings. Now, these scams come in all shapes and sizes, everything from fake lotteries to phony investment schemes. But here in Marin County, they say the most lucrative schemes they're seeing involve online romances.
That's just one among dozens of Florida news stories about the problem, but it seems the news isn't getting through to a lot of prospective attorneys in this country. That's why Ted Merman is crisscrossing the nation, delivering an urgent message to law students. He dropped by the Florida State University College of Law last month to address students and faculty there.
Part of it will be on senior-related issues, and part of it will be on the general effort to raise the profile of consumer law and economic justice in law schools around the country. That's a program that we run out of the center at Berkeley.
That's the Center for Consumer Law and Economic Justice at the UC Berkeley Law School, where Merman is the director. He believes with the incidence of senior fraud exploding, this is a legal arena that far more law students need to consider.
I think it's a very important set of defenses that you're providing to students, for sure. It also gives them an immediate way to help people, including their own family, right from the beginning. A president of the United States once said, "We are all consumers, every one of us." And that is absolutely true. So it's an area that we all should be interested in.
But there may be some new challenges on the horizon. It's likely the incoming presidential administration may dismantle at least some of the current consumer law protections in favor of industry self-regulation. Merman sees this as a response that falls short.
Self-regulation, unfortunately, is susceptible to one or two members of an industry deciding that they aren't interested, and that can drag the whole industry down. So I think it makes a lot of sense to come up with a series of regulatory principles that can be put in place in law that an entire industry would then need to follow.
Merman thinks those legal protections also need to provide more aggressive enforcement mechanisms, also a challenge since so many scams have international origins.
It would also be a nice thing to see some piece of the energy and the excitement going into countering those scams and having a positive sort of arms race on the consumer side to ferret out the problems. And that will happen over time, but I think that it's something I'd like to see encouraged.
And just maybe the need to protect people, especially vulnerable seniors, from fraud may be one of those rare bipartisan issues that nearly everyone can support, regardless of politics.
I do think that eventually there's great consensus in this country about the sorts of protections that we want to have in place. Again, if it happens to you, happens to some member of your family, I have seen minds changed by having that happen. And I think that there really is more agreement than people realize about the kind of a society and the kind of a marketplace we want to live in.
In the meantime, Ted Merman will continue his pilgrimage to law schools across the country, urging more law students to consider a career in consumer law. Starting this month, Florida kids 13 and younger can no longer have a profile on certain social media sites. This includes Snapchat, Quora, and Discord. A new law seeks to prevent children under 16 from opening social media accounts, though it would allow parents to give consent for 14 and 15-year-olds. While the law went into effect January 1st, the state has agreed to hold off on implementing it for some platforms as a lawsuit moves forward. Adrian Andrews spoke with legal and tech experts to understand how Florida can enforce the law and the chances of it holding up in court.
Paul Taske is the Associate Director of Litigation at NetChoice. He says the law infringes on users' right to privacy and free speech.
This law would present a barrier for anyone who wants to access lawful speech on the internet.
NetChoice and the Computer and Communications Industry Association represent tech giants such as Google and Meta Platforms. They filed a federal First Amendment lawsuit in October challenging the social media ban. Taske says the companies worked out a deal with Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody for the state to hold off on enforcing the law against platforms they represent until the court rules on a motion for a preliminary injunction.
The state will stay enforcement or has agreed not to enforce the law against NetChoice and CCIA members.
That case is scheduled for a hearing in February. But there are still many unanswered questions. How can social media companies verify someone's age? And how will the state even know if sites are checking for that sort of thing? And does this law really break the First Amendment? According to the law, the age verification process must be anonymous and should be handled by a third-party company. But the verifier can't use someone's personal information, like a credit card or driver's license. Jason Frankovitz, a computer scientist and software engineer out of California, says Florida's language should be a bit more specific, especially if it wants to crack down on kids using online platforms.
They basically say some age verification process that's based in the United States that is in the business of providing age verification. So there's some wiggle room there for them to come up with something that is going to be most suitable to help enforce this law.
Frankovitz believes the legislature will have trouble enforcing a social media ban because the law applies only to companies that target specific audiences. According to the law's text, if apps have a percentage of kids spending at least 2 hours per day on them, as well as those that have addictive features such as infinite scrolling, the company will have to comply with the law or face penalties up to $50,000. Frankovitz argues the state will probably never see that money because companies won't easily hand over information about the demographics and trends of their users.
How many users are accessing which of these features and what types of content is being used on those features and the demographic breakdown of the users who are adding that content when using those features during this time of day, only the internal technical people within the company really have access to that data.
Other states like Arkansas and California have seen their social media regulations temporarily blocked by the U.S. Supreme Court, and big tech companies have said they'll continue suing Florida on free speech grounds.
This is what's called a prior restraint on speech, which is even a greater burden.
Timothy Shields is an attorney in Fort Lauderdale. He represents software companies and social media influencers. He believes the state will face legal pushback for reasons other than First Amendment concerns. He points to the section of the law that allows 14 and 15-year-olds to keep their accounts with parental consent.
The two gap years where they can be online with parental approval also raises some constitutional questions about if this is harmful. You know, we typically don't allow harm to be waived by parental consent.
NetChoice and the state will meet in court next month. I'm Adrian Andrews.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, customers of Florida's largest power company will see a small bump in their monthly bills in the new year because of the 2024 hurricane season. In December of 2024, the Florida Public Service Commission unanimously approved a $1.2 billion interim recovery package for Florida Power and Light. It's aimed at covering power restoration costs for Hurricanes Debby, Helene, and Milton. The money will also help replenish a storm reserve fund. Florida's utility leaders say they're responding to a trend of stronger and more unpredictable hurricanes. And all of that preparation comes at a cost. State regulators heard their presentations before the busy hurricane season started, as Gina Jordan reports in this story that was filed in May.
We no longer feel comfortable that a Category 1 is going to stay a Category 1.
Armando Pimentel is president and CEO of Florida Power and Light, which provides electricity for nearly 6 million accounts across half of the state.
But the storms certainly appear to be bigger and stronger now than they have been in the past. And we and others have been surprised by the increase of intensity of those storms in a very, very short period of time.
Take Idalia, for example. It zoomed through warm Gulf waters last August, going ashore in Keaton Beach in the Big Bend. It quickly escalated into a Category 4 storm before dropping to a 3 at landfall. Pimentel says it's not the first time a storm has intensified so unexpectedly, and he notes the waters are warm again this year.
Understanding that it's important for your customers to have power on as quickly as possible after a storm, we and others are going to be a little bit more conservative than we've been in the past, right? Because now we can't miss a Category 1 storm turning into a Category 4 or 5 storm and not being well prepared.
Utility leaders told the Florida Public Service Commission it's becoming more of a challenge to line up assistance from neighboring states when a rapidly intensifying storm could hit their area. As a result, nearby states that usually send help are holding on to their manpower and resources longer.
We find ourselves nowadays, because of the unpredictability of these hurricanes, you're planning for a circumstance that's worse than it's being forecasted. And you're also receiving resources that are coming from much farther away than they probably were coming from historically.
Tampa Electric Company President and CEO Archie Collins says crews came from as far away as Illinois, Virginia, and Arkansas to help after Idalia.
It is becoming an increasingly difficult game to figure out how to find that balance between being well prepared and not overspending on planning for an impending hurricane.
The News Service of Florida reports the state's four private electric utilities, FPL, Tampa Electric, Duke Energy Florida, and Florida Public Utilities, can pass along the cost of hurricane preparation and recovery to customers.
Storm preparedness is right up there with our commitment to safety, reliability, resiliency, prudent spending. And that is what allows us to basically stage an army. And that's what all of us have to do.
Duke Florida President Melissa Satius says storm prep is a huge part of what they do, and bringing in crews is a significant expense.
We are literally staging an army. We've got to house them, we've got to feed them, we've got to get their clothes washed. And of course, we need to help keep them, to keep them safe.
The point you're really hitting home is increased the intensification of storms, and that to be prepared for that is going to necessarily be more costly.
Florida Public Service Commissioner Gabriella Pasadomo said utilities will have to balance the needs of customers with trying to navigate storms that are becoming more unpredictable. I'm Gina Jordan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Tom Flanagan, and Happy New Year. We hope you'll join us throughout 2025 for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.